Reading from the Yoga Sutras, text chapter 1, text 32. Practice of fixing the mind on one object. One second. I want to make sure they don't. Practice of fixing the mind on one object should be performed in order to excuse me. I got to get some water here. One second. In order to eliminate these distractions, Om Gyana Timarandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chaksuran Mulatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Shayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sapadantikam Adadanaschanam Dante Idam Yache Puna Puna Srimadrupa Padamboja Tulisham Janma Janmani Mancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Shindhu Bhayevacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Siadvaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Ramo, Hare Ramo, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So greetings from Besant Falls. I'm staying at my, I guess my living quarters, graciously offered by Sachisuta and Kali Lita. Last couple of months, since I came from India, I've been constantly traveling. It's nice now to set in your own space where everything is organized according to your needs to serve Krishna. But even though it's a country setting, it's quite a dynamic place. Mother Kalini lives next door, saintly lady, and a lot of people around here interested in spiritual life. On Saturday, just 15 minutes from here, there's a yoga studio, and I spoke for 3 hours as part of their yoga teacher training, speaking on the psychology of yoga. Really, so many evolved people who are serious about spiritual life and also have a natural inclination and affinity for bhakti, and all sorts of people. One really nice man was a graduate of West Point and then 7 years an officer. And then when he got out of the military, he studied and became a doctor. And, you know, he sort of got into yoga for, because he was an athlete for exercise and, but here he was listening very intently. It's kind of a new world for him. He didn't come from the hippie class or the straight edge class, or so interesting and eager to understand this great tradition of knowledge coming from Shastra, Indian sacred texts. Let's see. So we're discussing yoga, a particular psychosomatic process whereby meditation or focusing on one thing, one is able to ignore or neglect all the rambling thoughts of the mind that distort the nature of the mind, and in distorting the nature of the mind, distort the mind's function to act as a mirror for the soul. If the mirror is distorted, the function of the mirror to reflect things becomes distorted. We discussed this. And then this option was given of worshiping God and discussed extensively, especially in terms of the sutras, which are so frugal in terms of words. So if something is extensively discussed, it has some importance. So he discussed the Ishvara Pranidhan, gave the option that the object of your meditation can be God or the worship of God, which means to focus on God in the form of shabda sound with worship means with devotion. And this was recommended as very effective, and we discussed this. And then this focus and this meditation on Om is very, very powerful. We're seeing it perhaps in another context than most of us as Krishna Bhaktas and chanters of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra may perceive, but it's very, very powerful to meditate and control the mind and focus the mind with devotion on God in the form of God's manifestation, non-different from God in terms of the names and sounds of God. There is absolute relation between the name, the signifier, and what's being described. So very, very powerful. This is a very, very powerful process. And then he mentions, I think this is text 29, from this comes realization of inner consciousness and freedom from all obstacles. So this meditation, it's and the simple example is always given when the sun is manifest and you can see yourself. So it's that type of concept, this absorption. In Ishvara, in God, then one also realizes oneself as part of Ishvara, and this self-awareness or self-realization is the goal of yoga. And in those commentaries, there were quotes describing this. The people of staunch faith in Vishnu, the remover of illusion, Vishnu reveals the self, which is different from matter, and he reveals it just like a lamp. So the Puranas, the Shastra is pervaded by these texts. I was thinking in Bhagavad Gita, in the Chaturshloki Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, text 11. Tesham evanukam partham aham gyanajam tama nashiyam yatma bhavo sto gyanadipena with the light of knowledge, bhasvata, glowing. to one who is Tesham Satatayukdanam Bhajatam Priti Purvakam. To those who Tesham Satatayukdanam, Satatayukdam, always engaged, Bhajatam, in worshiping God. How? Priti Purvakam, in devotion. Same process. So those who are worshiping God in devotion, to them, Tesham Evanukampartam, Anukampa Artam. I show them really valuable mercy. Aham Agyanaja, that I Atma Bhava within their hearts destroy with the Jnana Dipena, the shining lamp of knowledge, the darkness born of ignorance. So this is the result, and we should take heed to this. This is the process. There's nothing more important than our meditation on the Holy Name with some type of concentration. And there's reciprocation. If we do it sincerely, if we do it with some detachment, some understanding of its importance, and then freedom from all obstacles. So this is also classic, the nature of devotion. I described that before, how the process of bhakti works inside out, rather than just working to mold the mind to reveal the soul. Bhakti stirs the soul, which then affects the mind. Srinvata swa kata Krishna punya shravana kirtana hidyantisto, in the heart hidyantisto bhadani vidanoti suritsitam, God who's close to the devotee, vidanoti surit satam, close, very close hearted, vidanoti, he cleans, he removes the obstacles. So then there was a description of what these obstacles are and the definitions of them. We discussed that. And then not only these various obstacles are removed, but by those obstacles, they produce... those obstacles, they have accompanying distractions, which are also removed. So this is what, so these obstacles are removed. And now, today's verse is the concluding verse of Ishvara Pranidhan, the concluding verse of the option of fixing the mind on God in the form of his designated sound vibration, and the practice, this is of fixing the mind on one object, should be performed in order to eliminate these distractions. So confirm, if you want to remove all these distractions, you should practice fixing the mind on one object, and in this case it's talking about Ishvara. It's concluding this section on Ishvara. So this is there. Now, what's gonna be discussed? This is very interesting. This is very important. To prepare the mind for meditation, because one is dealing in the world, to prepare oneself for meditation, one has to have the appropriate dealings with others. And very interesting. It says, by cultivating the attitude of friendship, compassion, joy, and equanimity towards situations of happiness, distress, virtue, and vice, lucidity arises in the mind. Prasadanam, chitta. In the mind, this arises, this lucidity, which is essential to meditation. That really means the mode of goodness. So it's not the goal in itself, but it's just a commentator says like arithmetic is important to arrive at some total of something. So these attitudes are very important to prepare the mind for meditation. And four types of situations: happiness, distress, virtue, vice. And basically, we run into these situations in terms of other people. So I described this before, but happiness means one more happy than one, generally, in some way. Better relations, more money, healthier, more famous, better position. So we're always confronting those situations. And distress, one who is less fortunate than us, one who we could lord over, is in a lower social status, has less money, less power, less prestige, less intelligent, etc. Then virtue, one who is more pious, and vice, one who is less pious. So it describes the first thing is friendship, or you become well-wisher. So if someone is happier than one, let me just see the next verse. If one is happier than one, then one has to be their well-wisher. You have to be happy for their happiness. Because if one is not, then one will fall prey to envy, which brings the mind away from lucidity. Lucidity of the mind means the pure, it means sattva, the pure state of the mind. And you have to come to that. The mind has to start developing goodness for this type of meditation. This is actually a very advanced process described in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. When they're talking about yoga, chitta, vritti, nirodha, as Prabhupada said, they're not talking about 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the evening. This is a very, very serious endeavor, mentioned in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, seclusion, celibacy, etc. So you have to really focus to get this kind of result in yoga. So our moods and attitudes bring the mind away from its pure state. Envy is born of passion and mostly ignorance. So envy distorts the mind. So we're so prone in our dealings. Anyway, we can even have a meditation now. Is there anybody that you are unhappy that they're better than you? That you would like to not do so well? I try to fight those feelings, but I can say honestly, I'm confronted with them sometimes. I think I'm mature enough in devotional service to abstract myself from them, those type of feelings, and look at those feelings and reject those feelings and not absorb myself in those feelings. But I can't say that those feelings don't arise. But when they arise, I try to follow this. I try to be happy for that person consciously, although the impulses of the mind may say something else. Due to conditioning, and material desire, we may wish ill of others, that they don't do well, they don't get that happiness, that they don't speak so nicely, better than us, or they don't make more money than us, or they don't become more popular, whatever. And that when those impulses come out, this is teaching us that they're born of envy. And you have to cultivate this mood of friendship of others who are happy, being their well-wisher. Friendship means when you really a friend of someone, you are wishing them well. If someone's really your friend, and they call you up and they say, "My God, I won the lottery," or I don't know what they could say, or "Oh my God, you know, I just got this inheritance," and you go, "Damn, I wish it was me," you know. It's not, then you're not a friend, but their happiness should be your happiness. Yes, wonderful. Let's forget the lottery thing. Wonderful. So you deal with those people in the mood of friendship, and those that are distressed, the you can see again, if someone is less than you, how do you respond? Are you happy that they're less than you? Does it give you a satisfaction that you're superior to those people, that you have more money? That you have more money, or you're higher socially, or you're more intelligent, more whatever it is. No, but the tendency is of the mind is when someone is lower, the tendency is to want to lord over them, to be happy that they're lower, because that puts you in a happy. But no. Their distress, para dukkha dukkhi, that's that famous verse, Raghunath Das Goswami glorifying Sanatana Goswami, Vairagya Yugvakti Risham Piyatnai Apaya Mam Anabipsamandam Kripambudhiya para dukkha dukkhi Sanatanastam Prabham Asriyami. That Paraduka Duki glorified that he has no unhappiness, Paraduka Duki, but his happiness is the unhappiness of others. So if you don't cultivate that, which is called compassion, empathy, if you don't feel for others and want to help them, but actually are happy that you're in a superior position, then you won't become free from the tendency to lord over others and be aggressive either mentally, you know, with your words or whatever. And that's ignorance. That really distorts the mind. And here it says joy when someone, in terms of virtue. Again, same thing. You're actually happy when you see someone more saintly than you. You're actually happy, especially when it's a contemporary. Sometimes it's very difficult. We may feel, I've come before this person, but I'm looking and I'm seeing so many devotees that are more advanced than me. And how do I, again, the same thing, envy. How do I respond to that? How do I respond that they're actually much more advanced than me? I was thinking of my bhajan today, and I was thinking of the bhajan of one of my godbrothers, and I felt I'm nothing. But how does the mind actually react? But with joy. Otherwise, envy distorts the mind, and those who are struggling, less spiritually fixed, then there's tolerance, because otherwise intolerance overcomes the mind. So this is right after the verse about Therefore, we should keep the mind focused. The practice of focusing on an object should be there. This is the whole conclusion of Ishvara. Therefore, because it will reveal, give you light, and reveal the inner consciousness, you'll be able to see yourself. Because it removes all obstacles, you should practice this, you should remain fixed. But now it says how you do that, how you come to that platform. You have to be very, very careful how you deal in the world because you're spending so much time in the world. How our response to others can affect our consciousness in a negative way. And now what's going to happen is, and we'll probably just start with one today, and perhaps I've gone a little bit. No, I've got a few verses. I got it, yeah. So now he's going to give different ways other ways how to fix the mind. That the obstacles, in other words, it said the obstacles you can become by fixing and concentrating the mind on an object. It was talking about the syllable. So now there are other ways to do this. He says, or stability of the mind is gained by exhaling and retaining the breath. Now, when they say stability of the mind, this is the first section, and the first section is talking about yoga, chapter one. Now, chapter two, which we haven't gotten to, is how to come to that stage. This is actually talking about a fairly advanced stage of meditation. In other words, this meditational process to really have this kind of dynamic transformation of the mind requires a certain level of prolonged and uninterrupted fixedness. So, how to maintain and develop this? Well, here it says by exhaling and retaining the breath. Breath control can bring this stability of the mind. The breathing technique, the body becomes light and the mind becomes steady. If the breath is subdued, produced steadiness. These techniques, one-pointed concentration, there's three things. There's exhalation, inhalation, and then there's retainment of breath. This is pranayama. These are advanced techniques of pranayama. The breath, the mind, very, very connected. And when it's done in a proper way, it has a tremendous effect on the mind. I saw that even this morning. I felt from traveling it was taking a toll on the body, and the body is connected to the mind. And I came up from a Hobith and then a long drive. And then on Sunday, I drove 2 hours out to Hartford. They had like a kind of a campground type Rath Yatra, the first one there in Hartford. So I went out there 2 hours. Baking in the sun, which is terrible for me. I'm pita constitution, so I can't take the sun. Baking somehow in the sun and dehydrated, and then after, you know, being there for a few hours, then coming back for 2 hours. So this morning, the first thing I did was some exercise early in the morning, yoga exercise. Mechanical, deals with the body, it deals with the breath, but it has a profound effect on the mind. And when you want to really get into these very, very high levels of meditation, when the body is just completely still, The mind is completely fixed for long periods of time. Then there are very advanced techniques to do this. It's mechanical, but it's the science of how the mechanism of the body and the mind and the life affairs work. So you can do it this way. And this is very interesting. Or else, sense activity, focusing on a sense object arises, and this causes steady of the mind. Now this is very, very interesting. Because what Patanjali is saying here, and this is done. In fact, one of the commentators, you know, really spoke about it, and he described, and this is attainable even actually by us, that if you focus on one of the sense objects, and it, you know, basically, it's a type of meditation. Practice continuously for a couple of days, maybe 4 or 5 days. And the state of fasting or meager diet in a place where there's no disturbance. So if you meditate on a particular sense, you'll somehow or other be able to enter into a more subtle level of that sense. And there'll be some extraordinary sensual experience, actually. If you meditate on the nose, a very incredible aroma will come. And it's kind of interesting that this verse happens, because that this verse is talking about this type of thing, because I became interested when I would visit Kasturba's yoga studio. I began to meet some of the people there, and some of the people there were yogis. Some, not all, a few, were yogis. And there was this one lady that came to Janmashtami and was just like amazed. She was just amazed. She was just saying, it's so different, you know, because kirtan and, you know. But I somehow got to know her because she came to visit Vrindavan. And Kasturba contacted me, and I was able to facilitate them in Vrindavan. And definitely, they were yogis. Their minds were very, very controlled. And she explained to me that she would go on these Vipassana meditation retreats. And they hold these retreats. And, you know, I guess it's silence for 6 days. You know, I have to talk for 6 days, and they do different. So you put yourself in a confined environment where the senses are controlled. And she explained exactly this happened. She was trying to explain it to me, but I didn't read this yet. She said, you know, you focus on your breathing, and then this very, you know, amazing, after like a couple of days, this amazing aroma comes. So this is one of the ways to kind of steady the mind. You focus on a particular a sense object. And remember again what Patanjali's doing. Patanjali's is creating a particular school of thought by establishing a sutra. He hasn't created this school, but he's gleaning from the greater tradition of his contemporary tradition of the various schools and shastras how the mind is controlled. So he's giving the different options, and he's putting it in his sutra. I'm going to read. Vyas and the commentators understand the present verse to refer to super sensuous experience. It's a very interesting reason why this is done, and it has to do with faith, because yoga takes a tremendous amount of effort, and whenever you have to sacrifice, you have to have faith to do that. Even Aranyakashipu, he had faith. He had somehow in that culture, he performed all those austerities, but he accepted his science. He knew the result. A lot of times faith comes with some preliminary experience, just like many of us who came to the Krishna Bhakti tradition may have had religious experience. I know that I did. And that, you know, gave me a certain type, kind of an introductory offer, but certain type of faith to undergo the austerities to actually perfect that process, just like the story of Narada Muni. He was meditating, and then relatively quickly, by his meditation, he got Sakshat Darshan. He got direct vision. But then it didn't come as easy. So he got kind of an introductory offer, something to manifest, to instill faith. Because, again, remember, vigor or effort is based on faith, and faith is generally based on some kind of experience. So in the yogic process, this was also a way to get some experience, and oh yes, it works, it is true, there is a mystic process, to actually carry people forward in the process. So I'm going to read a little bit. Same thing with Narada Muni. He got that experience. He's able to. I know in Krishna consciousness, when I, you know, some of the experiences I had, especially first coming, where there was such a taste in the holy name, super sensuous. On the platform, I don't know, on the platform of the heart, super experience on the platform of the heart. And remember, you know, prasadam, not super sensuous, beyond just mundane tastes. Vyasa and the commentators understand the present verse to refer to supersensuous experience. Vyasa states that if one concentrates on the tip of the nose, one can experience a divine or supernormal sense of smell. If you want to do this, you can get it. The palate, one can experience a supernormal it says color, but palate means tongue. Anyway, the tip of the tongue is supernormal taste. The middle of the tongue, The palate, one can experience supernormal color. The tip of the tongue, supernormal taste. The middle of the tongue, supernormal touch. And the root of the tongue, supernormal sound, divine sound. These experiences fix the mind, eliminate doubt, and of the doorway to samadhi. The specific term manas samadhi is you hear Patanjali. Since in traditional Sankhya it is the specific aspect of chitta directly interfacing with the senses. So through the manas. So it gives one experience of higher realities. And when one is afflicted with doubt in the sometimes credible claims of the sacred texts, this pushes one forward. So that's where what I'm up to today. So to recap, now after finishing Ishvara Pranidhan, and some discussion of how to relate in the world so that one could come to a level of samadhi. Now it's giving different optional ways to fix the mind so one can achieve this level of awakening of inner consciousness and the destruction of the obstacles that are born from the fluctuations of the mind. Okay. Anybody like to ask a question or say hello?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
This is Gail.
Gail, Hare Krishna.
I guess when you were talking about, you know, the, I guess, intricate breathing techniques,
yeah,
that can help you,
I was
thinking, well, it made me feel that probably my own breathing techniques are probably not, you know, very, I guess, effective or adequate.
Yeah.
Because although, you know, what I do wasn't with the intention to employ a breathing technique, it is, I guess, a kind of control breathing. Because what I do is I, whenever I do chant, I do three mantras on a breath, you know, and so in that way my breathing is controlled, but I don't know if that, you know, counts as a kind of...
Well,
content.
I mean, there are different levels. So definitely something like that, controlling the breath will help to control the mind, there's no doubt. But this here is discussing of an advanced technique where there's like retention of breath also.
You
know what I'm saying? You breathe in, there's a retention of breath. This is advanced pranayama.
Uh-huh.
But there's, you know, but as the breath is connected to the mind, anytime we control the breath, then the mind becomes controlled. Even if we're like really like, you know, someone experiences some trauma or something and they lost control of themselves. And it, you know, someone will say, take a deep breath.
Mm-hmm.
It just, breath, it affects the mind, our breathing, yes.
Mm. It helps to still the mind.
Yes. Yes.
Maj?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought there was a pause there. I don't want to step on the...
I'm done.
Sorry. Thanks, Gail. I want to ask you about super sensuous experience.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that in Krishna consciousness as well, in Bhakti Yoga, we sometimes have super sensuous experiences of a sort, and that for many of us, at least you gave your example, but I think it holds for a lot of us, it holds for me, that early tastes of those kind of experiences are what encourage us to go on sometimes.
Yeah.
Do you think that those kind of experiences are really different from the kinds that the Yoga Sutra are talking about, just in the sense that it seems to me the Yoga Sutra experiences take place in a context of sensory deprivation, where they're super sensuous because, in fact, the senses are not being stimulated. And yet the bhakti experiences are ones where the senses are being stimulated, but there's supposed to be a deeper content than merely what is conveyed by the senses.
I think the when I say super sensuous, I mean a deeper content than what is revealed by the senses.
Okay.
Because it's again, the result may be the same, but you can get there in different ways. For example, chaito, dharpana, marjana, right? The chaita is cleaned, chaita, dharpana, marjana. The chaita, which is like a mirror, is clean. So that describes classic yoga, but it's not the same way. It's coming from the stirring of the heart cleanses the mind, not one's vairagya and jnana and vairagya, not one's manipulation of the mind. One is like, you know, doing it in one way and one is doing it in the other way. So it's completely different. And I would say with these super sensuous experiences, what you say beyond the content of the senses, one, is sensory deprivation that somehow or other in the metaphysics revealed by yoga and Sankhya, kind of more subtle metaphysics, which modern science doesn't seem to have access, but is real nonetheless, can be accessed in particular ways. You somehow, by that sensory deprivation, you go to another level and experience something. So bhakti is also experience. It's not that. I mean, we experience some kind of, when I say super sensuous, yeah, I can, you know, like the name, the holy name just gives you incredible pleasure, but I guess it's more connected with the heart. You know, it's not just the nature of the sound, but it's also connected to the heart. But nonetheless, but it's interesting too, because I know, speaking to a scholar in Vrindavan, that it's very, you know, God has a way of inspiring our faith, but at the same time, not doing it in a way that doesn't dampen our effort. You know, so he may give us a taste, but then doesn't keep on giving us a taste, because he knows that to make that kind of experience permanent, it has to come from us. So he can't keep on giving it. He has, but he gives it so that we continue. And he doesn't give it so we continue in the effort. And in that regard, someone, a sadhu in Vrindavan I was discussing with, who is a scholar, I should say, a scholar in Vrindavan, confirmed to me, you know, quoted to me some commentaries on the Bhagavatam where it describes that dreams can be a way in which the transcendence appears to someone to give them faith. And I had that experience in a very, very difficult time where I had some dreams which were required to give me a certain type of hope and confidence to keep me fit in very difficult circumstances. So I think that's, I guess it's just a phenomena that you see in different paths in different ways. Yeah. Anything else?
No, it's okay, Marsh. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay. I don't mind ending the class early.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hi, Bo. Rasika.
Hi, Bo. This is Rasika.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. That was a really good class. I liked the points that you brought up about, you know, dealing with other people and how, you know, even though those thoughts might come up,
right,
you know, after chanting for so many years and understanding the process, you can at least discern.
Well,
and,
yeah,
you know, be able to push something aside, even if you're not feeling it fully, you can feel it. You can make like you feel that way, and then it actually transforms it.
Well, yeah, it's a fact. It can be like an impulse that's irrational,
mm-hmm,
that you don't buy into.
Yeah.
That's what I would look at it. You don't buy into it. And if you if you buy into it, your mind becomes completely polluted.
Yeah.
And, yeah,
it's interesting because, like, in theater work,
yeah,
when you're playing a part, sometimes the part is a little foreign,
yeah,
or you find a part of it's a little foreign to the nature, but you have to find some way to get into it.
Yeah.
So it makes me think sometimes of that even though, you know with your intelligence the right thing to do, so you allow yourself to go there, and then the other becomes more clear somehow.
Uh-huh. Wow, yeah.
Or like Prabhupada said to this one, remember the one man who didn't want to pay his obeisances, and Prabhupada said, that's okay, just pay them anyway, and you'll notice that something will, you know,
uh-huh.
And then he did. He paid his obeisances because Prabhupada didn't get, like, defensive or anything. And he said, wow, that, yeah, I see now.
Well, there is such a body-mind connection. I mean, you put your body down, you can, you know, it in the right, if you do things in the right attitude, then the actions will also invoke particular emotions. And also, the same way, not acting on something, will prevent certain emotions. So if certain emotions come up in the mind, for some type of envy, not acting on them will dispel those emotions. Yeah.
And then the point that Mahamuni brought up, I was thinking too how the regular yogi who's practicing asana and pranayama and stuff, a lot of times, even though they're very expert in their field, it's kind of like, depending again on the motivation, like do you want to gain some kind of mystic powers, you know, or what's the consciousness behind what you're doing? So the difference in bhakti, like Prabhupada said, all these siddhis are byproducts of bhakti.
Right. It's so not the devotee's objective to get them.
Yeah, and at the same time, it's real beneficial because I notice a difference when I practice a little bit of asana and pranayama, how much it helps to center and calm the mind.
It does. It does. But then you're using it for a particular objective.
Exactly.
But, anyway.
You said they both lead to the same thing. It's just a different way.
Some things lead to the same thing. Yeah, I mean, the in bhakti, just Vasudevi, Bhagavati, Bhakti Yoga, you know, some preliminary things come. But of course, in the path of bhakti, the objective of prema only comes from bhakti. It doesn't come from any other path. Thank you for that contribution. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, we can all end now. Panchakalpa Tuvya Chakravasindhavi Vajapati Dhambhavani Vajinavi.